From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2014 when New York State labeled Rochester's East High School an out-of-time school. According to the state, every effort possible was made to save the struggling school. Nothing had been successful enough. Unless the district placed East under the supervision of a receiver, it would close. Well, fast forward to July 2015, when the University of Rochester officially stepped in to become the school's EPO, the Educational Partnership Organization. UR representatives say the university did not take the request to partner with East lightly. In 2015, 33% of the class graduated on time. The dropout rate was 41%. The projected graduation rate for 2016 was 19%. University representatives say they recognized the crisis and couldn't stand by while East struggled. In July, U of R accepted the Board of Education's invitation to become the EPO, and in September of 2015, it welcomed its first class of students. This hour, we'll talk about the EPO's progress over the last few years. By the numbers, East's story has been one of success. Attendance and graduation rates have increased, the suspension rate is down, academics have improved, and as we'll hear from our guests, the culture has changed. Could East serve as a model for other struggling schools in the district? Now, that question comes at a time when the Board of Education and Mayor Lovely Warren are pushing for a state takeover or not. There's a lot of debate about what happens next. Much of the board says no. The mayor says at least a referendum in November. And the future of the entire RCSD is sort of thrown up in the air right now. Now, if East is a success story, could the model travel? A lot to talk about this hour with our guests. Sean Nelms is the superintendent of the East EPO, and I'm going to say his full title one time because it's going to take about half an hour. He's an associate professor and the William and Sheila Konar Director of the Center for Urban Education Success at the University of Rochester's Warner School of Education. I'm just going to call you the superintendent for the rest of the
hour. I love that. I love
that. Is that all right with you?
Thank you, absolutely.
It's great to have you back here. Lorna Washington is assistant superintendent of strategic planning for the East EPO. Lorna, welcome. Thanks for being here. The principal of East Upper School is Marlene Blocker. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Tanya Wilson Thavenason is the principal of East Lower School. Welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
And Kyle Crandall is here, a representative of the Rochester Teachers Association for East, president of the Beechwood Neighborhood Coalition, and he's been at East for 18 years now. Kyle, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Well, Superintendent Nelms, this is the most often invoked school in the district right now, from by my count. That's by board members, in particular board members who are talking about possible success stories. I'm sure you hear that too. And I'm sure you want to present this as a success story, so let's be as direct as we can here. What kind of a success story is it? Why do you think this has worked in 4 years?
You know, I think that East has definitely taken a step in the right direction, and it's because of the demand from the community itself. And so we began this project with surveying our staff, including our teachers, administrators, support staff, our parents, students, and community members. And we were clear to ask, you know, what is our desired state? We knew where we were. We knew we had 40% of our kids dropping out, only a third of our kids graduating, a large number of special ed students not making it past their freshman year. We said, what would the ideal school system look like? And through that process, we created a plan, the Educational Partnership Organization, or EPO plan, that reflected and represented all of those interest groups, wishes and desires. But then we also tied that to some of the best research that was out, that was being done nationally and internationally. And so between the authentic voice of the community and the research-based approach, we were able to create something that that met those needs. And so it was easy for people to buy in and to accept that change was inevitable, and to also accept the process for doing so. That does not mean that the change process was easy or simple or clean. But it does mean is that we agreed on the core values of the work. And so when we had disagreements, it was about the actions or process of getting there. We didn't argue at all about our core principles and what we value from a school that would represent what are our interests of those teachers, students, and administrators.
I'm going to read those numbers again going back 4 years. Because you mentioned a dropout rate around 41%. 33% of the class graduating on time, projected to go down to about 19%. That is hard. That's a hard place to start.
Absolutely.
For the team. For you, the team, and anyone. And that does not take away from the work from the people who had already been there.
Right.
But that says that the environment you're coming into is a very tall challenge here. So You can't change it overnight.
Right.
Where are you at now? Give me the numbers now, the dropout rate, graduation rate. How's it going?
Yeah, I will also say to you before I give those numbers is that, you know, this was a systems approach. And so what people ask is the EASE project sustainable? Can it be replicated? I always answer that question by saying this was a systems change. Many of the same teachers are in the school that were there before, including Kyle. Those few administrators who were also present at the time. Some of the parents have had kids go through the school for the last 16 years if they, you know, look at the span of their children. And what's changed has been the system. And that means an alignment of curriculum, alignment of resources, better social and emotional support with our counselors and social workers, increased parent engagement. Lorna will speak to that. A number of parents who are now demanding and a higher standard of excellence for their children, and we're meeting that challenge and that request. And so through all of that work, we start to see graduation rates this past June at 65%. Last June, that number was around 51%. So you see these large gains in performance, but those are the lagging indicators, the things that happen at the end of their senior year. Marlene could talk about the success rate of our students in math and science and English and social studies, and attendance rates being up, suspension rates being down. The things that define a successful school culture are the indicators that we focus on most, including the number of freshmen who leave ninth grade with the right credits to graduate. And I'll tell you, before the EASE EPO, only 48% of kids left ninth grade with five or more credits. That's unheard of. As an administrator in Russia and Rietta previously in Greece, that number always hovered above 90%. You would never expect more than half the kids to not move beyond their freshman year. And what happens to the next freshman class is the half of those kids that didn't make it become the new cohort of freshmen. So those kids are being inducted or indoctrinated into a system of failure. So this is this repeated cycle. Fast forward to last year, that number was around 73% of students moving from 9th to 10th grade with the right credit. So just taking that 48% and that 73%, that number itself is the first indication of success towards high school completion.
All right. So again, the graduation right now, around 65%.
Yeah, and that's just June, and that will increase this August.
Average daily attendance went from about 77% 5 years ago to close to 90 when you combine both schools,
yep.
Upper lower now.
Yes.
Okay. So more students are there.
Yes.
A lot more students are graduating. Sean, just because it is, I think, vital that we ask these kind of questions, only because in some schools, I'm not even talking about RCSD, I'm talking mm-hmm. about across the country, sometimes what you see is a little bit of cookbooks to make sure
Absolutely.
Everyone's graduating, or a student will graduate but not really be ready for academics at a different level.
Yep.
Give me a sense for the 65% of the students who just graduated from EASE. Mm-hmm. How many, first of all, how many are going to upper ed, higher ed? How many are going to go to college?
Well, I think that's a question that we don't know how many. We don't have any kids apply for the FAFSA. We can track the number of kids who apply for colleges, but when kids move to the next year, that's tracked through a national system
yeah.
called the Clearinghouse. So we get that data at the end of that following year. So
okay.
we'll start to collect that data. What I would say in terms of cooking the books, if you look at the rate of performance for students in the critical content areas, again, math, science, global studies, U.S. history, almost every single one of those indicators have doubled in students passing. And I'll allow Marlene to speak to that when she talks as principal, because it's because of her and her systems in place and the culture that she's built around college going or career going culture that those changes have existed. You're right. I think when you see these drastic, you see Atlanta as an example, you know, in
yeah.
the past
yeah.
where these books are cooked and kids aren't performing well. That's because I think that those organizations started with the actions, meaning that how can we get kids through?
Yeah, get them through, get them graduated.
We started with what does it mean to have a quality education that will prepare kids for college and career readiness. From that discussion, we decided that, and we realized that we didn't have a viable curriculum. So we weren't giving our teachers a clear pathway for success and what they should be teaching that's aligned grades 6 through 12 that will give kids the best chance of leaving high school ready for whatever pathway they choose. Careers are great, and so is college. And so by doing that, we had to increase the rigor in our classrooms. We had to change our teaching practices. We had to prepare kids and build time in the schedule for kids to get extra support during the day in areas that they struggle with in science or math. I don't know about you, but there became a point as a parent, my parents couldn't help me in high school anymore. When I got to chemistry and got to physics, my parents tapped out, and it was the school's responsibility to get me through, or Upper Brown program, or some other outside agency to help me. Our kids have that same challenge. There's a point in which our kids academic experiences may be greater than their parents. And so our school wrapped themselves around the academic support and the social-emotional support to make sure that happens. And you're right, Evan, when we look at some school systems, and we know this happened in some unsuccessful charter schools. I think charter schools are great. I think all school options are great. But some unsuccessful charter schools, you'll see that they'll take 100 kids their ninth grade year. They'll remove half of those kids and send them back to their local district. They'll graduate 50 of the remaining 50 and then say, we have 100% graduation rate. We don't have that option, nor do we want that option. We do not want to calculate our success based on the kids who remain. We want to calculate our success on the kids who started with us and who finished.
And a couple of points that I think are important. I get that college isn't the be-all, end-all for all kids. Mm-hmm. It's not a case where you want 100% of any college or high school graduating class to be going to college. The reason I asked is just because, and I also get that the way we measure students, I mean, it's not perfect. There's a lot of work being done to reevaluate that. But the reason I asked is just what Dr. Nelms was just saying. I mean, there are cases in other states where you have seen them sort of pulling students through. They graduate, in air quotes, but they're not really ready for academics at another level. So the 65% are graduating. If all 65% went to college, let's just say that hypothetically, how many do you think would be really ready to hit the ground running?
I would say anyone who's been with us for 4 years would be prepared to function in any college of their choice.
That's great.
And I think that they may need some remediation support.
Sure.
But listen, I went to an honor school in Buffalo, one of the top schools in the country, City Honors, and we had students who still left that school needing remedial courses in high school. And so I think it's school dependent, system dependent, and also child dependent. But I would say that any kid who graduates from East who's been with us for 4 years could enter any college and be able to function in a way that prepares them for success. And again, that's kid dependent. It's the coursework that they took, if they took advanced placement courses or not. We also offer 7 career technical education pipelines: culinary, vision care, optics. We have medical careers, information technology, teaching and learning institute. So we have a number of other pathways for students too, who may decide that college is not the right path for them first year out. So they want to go into the career space and then come into college and higher ed later on. Some may want a bridge year. That's a popular thing now amongst students throughout the country. But our goal and our core values is not to just graduate kids. It's to have kids graduate prepared for the next chapter in life. And I will say that the approach of just graduating kids has plagued urban settings for far too long.
So here you are now. You're going to love this question. You ready for this? Here you are now with 4 years in, with a lot of actual metrics that show something good is happening.
Yeah.
You want to see the state come in and take over the district?
You know, Evan, I some reason I thought you would ask that question. So what I would say is this. I think that there are a number of proposals that have been presented for how to best meet the needs of students in Rochester. And I would tell you that I have focused 100% of my energy, maybe 99% of my energy, on East and listening to the 1% of the other things that are happening out there. What I would focus, I would want us to focus on, if the state was here, if the board remained, is that we start to look at practices that are effective and to replicate them. I will tell you that this board has been extremely supportive of the EPO project. Now, that doesn't mean that it doesn't come with some disagreements or questioning a process. But for the most part, we get asked some very tough questions about East. I hear, Commissioner LeBron is, notorious for asking very thoughtful questions. But the key to that is there are thoughtful questions. She reads the packets, she does her research, and she asks these really deep questions.
She's also, in particular, interested in the dollars and cents.
Absolutely.
And is very well schooled in that.
As she should be. And I think that she should be all board members. That's their fiduciary responsibility.
Yeah.
But this board has asked very tough questions. And I think they're asking those questions to see how they can better replicate or implement some of these practices in other schools. I mean, I have to assume that is their intention. When it comes to the dollars and cents of this project, it's clear. Everything that we said we were going to do 5 years ago, we've either met or exceeded. And I have to remind the board and the community often that East was not a school that was failing. It's a school that had failed. And so to bring in social-emotional support for kids, to bring in literacy support for students, we had 2% of our students reading as proficient, according to the state, before we got there,
2%.
2% in English, 2% in math, and so if you consider where our starting point was and where we're headed now, to a point where we're being nationally recognized by a company, HMH, for our progress in literacy, that's huge growth. And that's attributed to our teachers in lower school, our reading teachers, our literacy teachers, who really focused on the critical skills that kids needed to to be effective. And our administrative team, who helped organize that and to eliminate barriers for teachers, but rather give them resources to be successful. So I would say that if the state came in or if there was a configuration change, I just hope that whatever is done acknowledges the work that's been done and allows other schools to have access to that. We have a leadership retreat next week, and we have three or four schools from the RCSD who will be joining us that week to learn about our teacher evaluation and observation process. Not evaluation to indict teachers on their practice, but to observe and evaluate in ways that allow them to grow and be better as leaders and learners in the classroom. And so that's the transformational change that I see happening at East, and the type of change that has to happen in urban centers, because we have a ton of knowledge and a ton of skills in urban centers. But the system is not aligned to allow those individuals to really do the critical work, then we'll continue to see cycles of failure.
Now, one more for you, and then we're going to talk to your colleagues about the work that they've been doing at East as we examine 4 years into the partnership between the University of Rochester and East, and a lot of indicators of tremendous success in those 4 years. If there is a criticism at all here, it's that, you know, East is in some ways like a charter school. And otherwise not. I mean, Dr. Nelms is pointing out, you can't do what some charters, again, not all charters here, but some could do in terms of who students you keep or not keep. I mean, you don't have options like that.
Absolutely have no options like that. Right?
So, but the real question with charter schools when they were created was, could you find this laboratory of education, and then could you learn from it and transfer the ideas? And some of the criticism is, well, even when there's success, you can't transfer the ideas. Here, the question I often hear is, even if there's success, we can't afford to do that at every school, so what are we doing here? Is that fair or not fair?
I think it's an unfair question. I think those questions come from those who don't understand what we're actually doing at East. And it's also unfair for them to never bring that up when 29% of our kids are graduating. Like, 29% grad rate, a 29% graduation rate is expensive. That's expensive. I mean, the resources that you have in the building, you're still pushing out 29 or 30% of your kids graduating is a very expensive proposition. So those who have visited East, and I've mentioned this before, those who have taken the time to understand what we're doing, they realize that changing systems, the original upfront cost is expensive, but maintaining systems are not. So for us to steal minutes within our schedule to give kids an intense support room / study hall experience every single day is a strategic response to that. It doesn't cost a ton of money. It doesn't have to cost a ton of money to create family group structures where students and staff meet every single day and share social, political, economic, academic issues and concerns, celebrations. That doesn't cost a school to do that. That's being thoughtful in your master schedule. The amount of time that Kyle puts in and the principals put in the summer trying to create a master schedule that reflects the kids' interests, it costs me to pay Kyle hourly and administrative team to adjust their time to do that work. It's not expensive. It's just making sure that making sure that kids have the first day of school be successful. If that's our priority, then that's where you put your dollars. So there are so many examples at East that I can rattle through around school change and school culture change, but systemic change that doesn't cost much at all. It really costs is someone to have a tough conversation about what those priorities are going to be. And I think that's the upfront cost we had. We had very honest and direct conversations with our unions, with our community, with our parents about how this change is going to take place. When we got to a place of friction, we anchored back into our values and our moral core. We said, this is what we agreed to. We can disagree on process. We can work through that. But if we're not disagreeing on why we're doing this work, that master schedules matter, that having a curriculum matters, that the curriculum reflects the ethnic and cultural representation of our students, that truly matters. If we're not focused in arguing on that, then the rest of our work becomes easy. And I think we're in year four. I think we're seeing the fruits of that labor the first 4 years and our ability to have substantive conversations about process and not about our core value and mission of the school.
Lorna Washington is the Assistant Superintendent of Strategic Planning for the East EPO and started right when this EPO launched 4 years ago.
Yes.
What was the biggest change in year one that started to spark some of these improvements? What do you think in terms of the culture of the school or the policy of how you were handling, whether it was discipline or approaches in different ways, what stands out to you that started to make the biggest change?
Yeah, it definitely was the culture of the school. We continued to see a shift starting in year one. We actually had a lot of teachers who had come on board who really just wanted to make sure that the kids were successful and actually worked to build relationships. So I think that from year one, we started to see that our that our kids were trying not to look at things from a deficit perspective, but really trying to focus on the things that were going to be showing that we were successful and showing that we could do this. Primarily, if I'm thinking about like family and community engagement efforts, when we first started with the EPO, there was one person who was on our PTO. And as we continue to grow over the 4 years, we've seen that, you know, that number has grown immensely. We have traditionally about 20 to 30 people who participate on our family and community engagement initiative, our teams who meet monthly, and they actually are doing things that are working for the school and helping to make decisions for the school now. Whereas before, this was more administratively led. This is really something that the families and the community have gathered around us and really have worked together.
You got more parents involved.
Absolutely.
How did you do that?
You trained them.
How did you do that?
Yeah, so I think the first thing was trying to build trust. We have a homeschool assistant, Angel Alicea, as well as our community coordinator, Jason Taylor, who really do a great job of working with our parents. And they are really hands-on in making sure that parents feel welcomed in the building. And another thing that we did, as Sean said, is training. We actually have taken some of our parents to national conferences, the Community Schools Conference and the Parent Engagement Conference, and just allowed them to get firsthand knowledge about what we're trying to do and bring that back and turnkey it to other parents. So they've been really involved in the process, and it's not something that's being done to them, but they're working in collaboration with us.
How would you say the overall culture is, though, in terms of parent engagement? Because I'm sure every district everywhere would love to see parents even more involved. What do you think 5 years from now it ought to look like?
5 years from now, I think that it will look like parents have taken this on and parents have really started to move this initiative without our help. Mm-hmm. And that's the whole goal, right? To make them more confident and more able to accomplish what they would like to. So like right now, we have our family and community engagement team is led by administrators, but we have parents who actually have worked together this entire year to create a co-chair to actually lead the committee. Now, that's something that we couldn't even think about doing year one with one representative.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, you know, I mean, some of these parents who would be there now, even if they're engaged now, in 4 or 5 years, their kids have graduated, but you're setting a cultural expectation that when your kids go to school there, you can be involved.
Absolutely.
And it's maybe even expected that you can be involved. What about in the way of suspension? There's a lot of talk about suspension rates. There's a lot of talk about discipline. What changed at East?
Well, with discipline, I think that, like I said, the culture shifted. So with the teachers and the administrators, families, students, everyone being on board, just making that shift and thinking about what it was that we wanted to accomplish, that's what really helped us to get our suspension rates down. And being able to employ some restorative practices and really think about the harm that's been done rather than just, you know, kicking people out of the building. So I think that really helped us to kind of focus on where we wanted to go and how we'd get there.
Superintendent Nelms, you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I think Lauren makes an excellent point. If I mentioned earlier, we surveyed all of our stakeholder groups, including students. And what students said is that they felt like this was an adult-centric building and they were being kicked out for no reason by security and that it was caustic at times. They could identify the teachers that they loved, you know, who really cared for them. We said, what do those teachers look like and sound like? And they would talk about how they gave them second chances and they actually got to know them and they loved on them and they supported them. We said, well, if the kids are saying that an environment which respects their authentic voice, that allows them to dissent. I mean, I have a child in high school, and she argues all the time, and I welcome that. I want her to have her own voice. If we're creating a system that doesn't allow that, then we're not preparing our kids for life beyond high school. And so we took what the kids said was key to them, adopted a restorative practice model, and from that model, we were able to create relationships between the adults and students, and in between the students themselves and between adults. I mean, there were adults who were not necessarily happy with their colleagues' approach towards students. And so being able to have that conversation, too, to say, what does it mean for us as an adult staffed and how and our engagement with students? What does that really feel like, look like, and mean for our kids? But also for the kids, what does it mean for you to appropriately and respectfully dissent with the adult? Right. You have to be able to have both conversations.
But this is where, Dr. Nelms, I had a conversation with a retired RCSD teacher who is not retired from East. It was a different school, but is sort of observing the spread of restorative practices. Mm-hmm. And this teacher He joked, he said, maybe I'm a curmudgeon, but it sounds to me like you're no longer allowed to control your classroom. That if someone throws an eraser at you, you can't suspend them. If someone is mouthing off, you can't discipline them. And I said, I don't think that's actually the goal here.
No.
But for that perception, which is out there, that yep. this is about a loss of control, what do you say to that?
I would say that students can be suspended still, and it's the process of reentering the school that's restorative. So what was the action that caused you to be removed, and how do you reenter the setting in a way that is respectful of the adult that you may have offended, a student that you may have offended, or the offense you caused upon yourself? And so I think for individuals who see this as control, and that's really a key term there, for teachers who see it as that their primary goal is to control a classroom, then honestly, those aren't the folks who should be in front of kids teaching. I'm going to say that honestly. I think for those who see the classroom as an opportunity to create an ecosystem of learners, including themselves, that's respectful of their voice, that does manage behavior, but not to control it. Like, there is no monarchy in classrooms. The distributed leadership model that we follow at East is that we create a system that's somewhat flat, but that everyone owns the success and failure of the school equally. And so students are a critical stakeholder group. They are our largest stakeholder group, arguably, within the school, are our students. And so for anyone who needs to control kids, there are other types of institutions where controlling adults occur. School should not be one of them.
And Lorna, after 4 years, tell me the aspect of the improvement that maybe you still feel like there's a big room for growth here. If we're sitting here 4 years from today, you hope, what aspect has changed the most?
Yeah, so one of the things that I'm hoping is going to change, and I've seen some growth with it already, is when the EPO first began, there were only about 5% of our scholars who attended East who actually lived in the neighborhood. And with East being a community school model, we've done a lot of work in recruitment and partnering with like Connected Communities, who's a community agency, and some of the neighborhood organizations to really try to increase the number of kids who live in the neighborhood who attend East. If you look at that number now, it's if you look at those who live within just over a 1 mile radius, there's about 20% or so who attend East. But if you stretch that out to 2 mile radius around East, that number jumps up closer to 40%. So 5 years from now, I would love to see, 80, 90% of our scholars actually living within the neighborhood and owning the school and really having a commitment not only to the school, but to that neighborhood.
I sometimes take for granted that some of our listeners who maybe are not RCSD, either graduates or parents or residents, don't always know the system of what's allowed. So what you're talking about is kind of an endorsement of what you're doing by the local neighborhood. But listeners may be going, well, where are those kids going to school? The kids who live close to you, where are they?
So the kids who live close to us, we have school choice process. They're yeah. allowed to be bused, so they can go to other schools, across RCSD. And East is not a school that screens out any kids, so we are part of the school choice process, so that's how kids are brought into the building.
And if you get to that 80-90% level, that'll be essentially an endorsement by everyone nearby that what you're doing is attractive. They want their kids there. Yeah. The kids want to be there. We're talking about the success of East and the EPO, the partnership that was launched with the University of Rochester 4 years ago officially. It has resulted in pretty remarkable changes in terms of daily attendance, suspension rates, graduation rates. Graduation rate now up at about 65%. District-wide, it's in the 50s. It's in the 50s
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yep.
So, it's significantly higher than the district-wide. And the superintendent is Sean Nelms, who is here with us. Lorna Washington is assistant superintendent of strategic planning for the East EPO. After our only break of the hour, we're going to talk to Marlene Blocker and Tanya Wilson Thavenason, who are principals of East Upper and East Lower. We're going to talk to Kyle Crandall, who is a representative of the RTA and has been at East for 18 years. And they're going to talk about what they have seen in the last 4 years, but also what they've seen change from their perspective in other schools or within East itself. Kyle's been there for 18 years. So a lot to talk about with one of the district's much heralded success stories. We're kind of trying to peel it back as to why what's worked has worked there. Short break, and we're right back. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on the next Connections. Have you done the Face app, where you see what you look like as an older person? Well, a lot of people have been doing that. And now you've probably heard that the Russians are coming. Well, not the Russians, but that app is a Russian app. And the real question is privacy and information. Who has your information now if you use the app? What should you know? How to protect yourself? We'll talk about it Monday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. A little bit of perspective now on the numbers as well as we talk about East and what has worked. 2014, as we mentioned right off the top, New York State labeled Rochester's East High School an out-of-time school. And as the superintendent now says, it was a school that had failed. So when you look at 2014-2015, Dr. Nelms, how many students do you have now at East? And what did you open with about 4 years ago?
Yeah, so when the EPO was created, it was designed to have 160 kids, grades 6, 7, 8, 180 kids, grades 9, 10, 11, 12. So we began with a much higher population of students. There's a little caveat there. In our second year, we realized that there were close to, with the state support, there were close to about 300 students who had not attended school in several years. Mm-hmm. And so we had to first try to find them, locate them, and then eventually had to drop them from the roster. So there was a drastic decrease from students who had never attended. And from that experience, again, understanding more about East in context, we shared that with the RCSD and said, you know, if it's happening at East, it may be happening at other high schools too. And that's actually an efficiency piece. If you know what your true numbers are, then you're able to better predict how many staff members you need in a school. Without doing that, you wind up having more staff than you need for the students who are physically present. So as of this year, we have about 669 or 600, almost 700 kids for the upper school grades 9-12. That number should be ideally around 760, so we're in the ballpark. And then grades 6 through 8, we typically only have enough kids to fill 7th and 8th grade, which is 180 each, but we're at 366. And that's because we don't have a feeder pattern. If you recall last year, we went through an extensive process with the RCSD to establish a feeder pattern with School 33 to ensure that we would have kids entering grade 6. We could have a true pre-K through 12 pipeline. Unfortunately, even though the resolution was passed, we weren't able to operationalize that. I know that this is something that's important to the school board and important to the new superintendent to establish these community school pipelines. So we will be revisiting that with the new superintendent shortly.
All right. Well, the principal of the upper school, East Upper School, is Marlene Blocker, who has been there all 4 years of the EPO, correct?
Correct.
And before then, where were you?
I was the founding principal of Rochester Early College International High School, and prior to that, I was the principal at Francis Parker School 23, which was an elementary building, and then I taught for 10 years.
You taught for 10 years, and you've been a principal for how many years?
18.
18 years. How did they convince you to take the job at East? Because I know, and I'm not trying to be flippant here, but you knew all the numbers. I mean, it was challenging.
True.
And tell me about how that first came to be, Marlene.
I met with Dr. Nelms. I had worked with him previously on other things, and he talked with me about the opportunity to make a greater change in Rochester. I had only been at the high school level the previous 5 years when I opened up the early college, and I felt like I was ready for another challenge. I knew it was going to be different, but I felt what was promising was the end vision and the support of the University of Rochester. And I truly believe if we could make an impact on one of our larger schools in the city, and then it could be replicated at some of our smaller schools, we had a true chance to change the trajectory of Rochester.
You've got a lot more students. I mean, from average daily attendance of about 77%, close to 90% now, so a lot more students are showing up now on average. A lot more students are graduating now. What's been the biggest reason for that? Give me the culture change that you saw maybe right out of the gate or that took some time to develop.
I think it has to do with building trust and building relationships. I think the kids, if you pick someone up off the street right now and said, what do you think is different at East for a student that had been there for years, they would say that they truly believe people are behind them and are there to support them. And I feel the U of R has really put in many wraparound services that were necessary for our kids. We know that they have been through trauma. We know that in order for kids to learn, they have to be able to focus on something besides the pain that might be taking place in their lives. And I feel like we have created a community at East in a culture that says we're all here to support you and lift you up and help you get to the finish line.
Now, one of the responses people may have to this is, well, if everything we're hearing this hour is true, why didn't everybody just do this, Marlene? Now, that that probably ignores the fact that some of what's happening at East is spreading, and it, whether it's restorative practices, which didn't just originate at East, of course, but what do you say to people who say, well, look, if everything you're doing at East is so successful, how come everybody in the district isn't doing that?
I think it also has to do with systems, and I think we have spent a tremendous amount of time trying to put systems and structures in place that are embedded in the day at East. I think they could be replicated at other buildings, and I think that's actually what our goal is, to show that by putting X, Y, and Z in place, it can lead to 65% or 70%, or wouldn't it be great if we were sitting here in a couple years and the graduation rate is 80%? So I think those things are possible, but I think in many places the systems and structures are not there, and it's not cohesive with the curriculum that we have aligned, the socio-emotional supports that we have in place, and the relationship opportunities. We have cohort town halls that take place each month to unite the cohorts that are going through. So you know who the person is next to you that should be graduating with you and somebody that you can lean on. We have family group every day that you can build relationships with a diverse group of kids you might not normally encounter and build relationships with staff members. It's not very often that teachers and kids know the intimate details about one another's lives that we've developed in family group. And when you have those relationships, it's much more difficult to create or offend or send harm to somebody else. And when you believe you have people around you that care, you can use those people to support you.
Before I turn to your other colleagues, Marlene, can you tell me a little bit about your thoughts about what you heard from Superintendent Nelms about the idea of the mentality of a teacher in your school, which is that Dr. Nelms is saying, if the mentality of the teacher is, I'm going to come in here and I'm here to take control, I'm going to control these kids, that's not the mentality that he wants.
Right.
And that's not to say that everyone's okay if there is no control or if there is chaos. But did you have to work with some teachers? Did you have any teachers who say, look, I don't get this, or this isn't working for me, or I you know, was it a struggle? Was it seamless? How did that go?
I think it was a great struggle the first year. When you look at prior to the year of us, the U of R coming in, there were over 2,000 suspensions, and we do reduce that drastically and have continued to reduce it. I think, Evan, you said something before that was really critical. You said, someone said to you, well, now you throw in someone throws an eraser at you and they don't even get suspended. To me and at East, the real question would not be an eraser was thrown. The question would be why. What would prompt a student to want to throw an eraser at somebody? And to understand the underlying reasons that are going on and how to fix, repair, and build that relationship. So if I'm frustrated with you tomorrow, I'm not going to throw that eraser. I'm going to say to you, could I talk with you after class in private? I also think it's much more difficult to throw an eraser at somebody when you know perhaps their child is going through cancer because you met with them in family group and you formed a relationship. Mm-hmm. Or that person has said to you, I can see you missed a few days because of something going on at your house. Why don't you come by during lunch and I'll help you catch back up? I think when you have built stronger relationships, you see a reduction in the need for people to act out in anger toward one another.
All right, Tanya Wilson-Fabenason is the principal of East Lower School, so get your grades 6 through 8.
That's correct.
What's the cultural change that you've seen that stands out the most?
I would say that at the middle grade level, I have two main focus. The first one is to create readers. If I can hand Marlene 9th grade students that are reading close or at grade level, then she can do anything with those kids. And that's not the expectation across the district, I would say. There's still so many kids trying to pass those high school regents without the ability to read and comprehend what's on the regents exam. So that's my first one, is making sure that literacy is one of the main things that we focus on at Lower School. And we do that through building our whole entire master schedule around literacy. And sometimes it gets frustrating to my friend Kyle across the room, but myself and other administrators will push back and say, no, you need to make this happen. This needs to be the foundation of what we're doing. So we've put a lot of energy and money into filling those gaps as far as literacy goes. The other piece is building those social emotional skills that scholars need in order to be successful both in life and in school. And we have kids that, as Marlene mentioned, have experienced some significant trauma and also have experienced some significant failure in school, including some of their parents. And so you're walking into a situation where we need to fill in a lot of gaps so that kids have those skills. Lots of times they call them soft skills to be successful in the world. And we have some programs specifically at lower school that attack the things that may have occurred to our students. There's a survey that we do with all of our kids that's called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Survey, which mm-hmm. is ACEs. And our students last year, 28% of them had experienced four adverse childhood experiences or more. When you look at the national average, it's somewhere more around 14%. And so we're almost double what the national average has as far as experiences go. And those impact kids from the start of their day to the end of their day every day. And we need to build some resiliency and some coping mechanisms in those students so that they can actually be ready to learn. They're not excuses for failure, but instead we just need to fill in those building blocks so that they're ready for the curriculum we have for them. So I would say those are our two main focus. And we do the social-emotional piece through having a very robust counselor and social work system. I have three counselors at lower school and two social workers. And when you work out that ratio, that's 1 to 66. There's one adult that is specifically trained to help you with your social-emotional needs for every 66 kids. If I had my choice, it would be even more than that, but our kids need that, and we've decided that we put our money where and our resources where the needs are. So for me, it's the social emotional support and literacy.
1 for 66, what's average in other schools?
I honestly can't even tell you what other high schools have. Dr. Nelms, do you have that number?
I know a national average for counseling, I think recommendation is, I think, 180 to 1, I believe. I think it used to, at one point it was. So
it's about a third of what the national average
may be.
Right. Okay. And you were a principal for how long before?
Before, I was a principal for 5 years at an elementary building.
What's the biggest difference from that building to the building you're in now?
Well, besides the fact that I don't spend my days tying shoes anymore.
The age of the kids. I get you there.
Yeah, you're right. No, I would say the biggest difference for me, I know Marlene talked a lot about the culture and the expectations and the relationships, but for me as a professional, this building has grown me more as a leader than any other experience I've had in all of my years in college, in my leadership training programs, in my doctorate program. The day-to-day work that we do together side by side, both with teachers and students and each other as administrators, has really enhanced my leadership abilities.
Well, Kyle Crandall's been at East for a number of years, a representative of the Rochester Teachers Association there. When you talk to people about how things are going there, and they're, you know, maybe they're RCSD parents, but their kids don't go to East, and they say, boy, I remember hearing stories about East. I mean, you've been there. What do you tell them now, then versus now? What's going on?
Well, I think, you know, Sean mentioned at the beginning, there were a lot of good things that were going on at East in the past as well. And I think one of the really key components here is we took this large, massive amount of students. I mean, for many years, East was the largest high school in the entire city school district. And so it was very easy for kids to get lost in the shuffle. I know that Tanya just talked a little bit about counselors, and I remember in the past when our counselors did have caseloads of 250 or 300 kids per counselor, that if I went and asked them a question about a student, they would have to say, let me go check on that, I'll get back to you. Whereas now, if I ask any counselor a question about a student, what you're going to hear is a response right then and there, because they know their students that well. So I think that is really the big thing. We've touched on that a lot. But the ability for those relationships to be able to occur simply because we have numbers that are somewhat controlled and enables us to be able to do that. The other good thing that I like, and this kind of my registrar scheduling hat, is that we've talked a lot about our intervention services, the literacy, that all of our kids get literacy services in grades 6, 7, 8, and 9. And yeah, that's a little bit of a challenge to schedule, as you've heard. But what I really like about this is we were able to restructure, because of the way that we've restructured our day, the extra hour that we spend is not just an hour after school where kids can, you know, be the beneficiaries of a bunch of different outside programs. That hour is embedded into the school day. So there was obviously, it took a bit to be able to negotiate and figure out how we were going to work through that in a contract. But what we have now is the ability for students to be able to basically have 10 classes within their day. We do block schedules, 72-minute periods, which meet every other day. So you have five of those per day. That's 10 over a two-day cycle. Whereas in the past, kids would only get to have 7 classes. So all of our students who needed intervention, be it some additional literacy, double period math, that would come at the expense of electives. And electives are a lot of times what kids are most interested in. Mm-hmm. So now what we can do within our schedule is we can give those kids the interventions that they need, the literacy, the double period math, and they can still have those elective classes that they care so deeply about. And so all of this just really plays in to give our students it sets them up for a much better chance for success.
And as the representative of the Teachers Association for East, when you hear the administrators here talking about this mentality of controlling classrooms, and I'm hearing from retired teachers going, boy, restorative practices, can you still control the classroom? You've heard their thoughts about that. What comes to mind for you?
So I think in general, the district East, we kind of joined around the same time the process of working through restorative practices. At the beginning, I'm not sure everyone really understood what restorative practices really was all about. And if there was one place where, and Sean talked about how, you know, we've struggled through some things together. And the piece I think that is most challenging for teachers and probably for students alike is if a situation arises, making sure that you actually have that follow-up conversation. That's what's so critical. And if that piece is missed, then so for example, let's take, you know, a kid gets removed from a classroom for whatever reason. They were disruptive to the class and the teacher gave multiple warnings, the kid didn't respond, the student has to be removed. If that student could go meet with a social worker, a counselor, they could be de-escalated. In that time, that student could then come right back around and be ready to get back into class. If there's no follow-up conversation between the student and the teacher may not quite be ready to be able to receive that student back yet because they haven't had a chance to talk and, you know, make sure that everything is resolved. So those conversations are what are so critical, be it peer-to-peer or be it teacher-peer, just making sure that there's time built in to be able to have those follow-up conversations.
In a minute or less, what do the teachers want to see improved there? Look, you got the floor. You got the ear of everybody here. You're the RTA rep. You can ask for more money. You can ask for whatever you want, Kyle. What do teachers need at East?
I think we need the consistency of being able to continue with the model that we currently have. Thankfully, we've been able to negotiate in good faith, a contract that we have said that we would do whatever we thought was in the best interest for students. But at the end of the day, it had to be fair to teachers.
And I hear you're blunt.
Our last contract was approved by our members 135-1, and that was a year ago when we extended our contract. And so, Sean and I have some tough conversations behind closed doors. But what I appreciate about that is it's relational. We can have those tough conversations. And so I would say what we really need is to continue to see this work through. That 4 years isn't quite enough. If we're really going to see this, see the results that we all desire, and trust me, we have an amazing group of teachers who work really, really, really hard. They care so much about their kids, and our ultimate goal is to see as many kids as we can graduate, and so we just hope that we get more time to be able to do that.
I'm not there every day, but just the numbers on paper, the work that you and your colleagues are doing is remarkable. There's no question about that. John in Rochester has got a question. We'll hit that now. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Yeah, I got a question. I heard most of the topic. As far as costs go, if you had to make an approximation of the percentage increase in cost to go to this affiliation with the U of R versus where it was before per pupil, do you have any handle on that?
Per pupil, yeah. Good question, John. I'll kick it to Superintendent Nelms.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things, John. The great question that we're trying to work through with the district around calculating the actual per pupil cost, because often the per pupil cost is based on the projected budget, not the revenues that are actually spent. Our last calculation and some reporting that was done by the DNC would suggest that East is around 27,000, and the district is around 22, close to 23. I don't want to confirm those numbers because we're still working through them, but the disparity between the two, that $3,000 or $4,000 per kid extra at East, primarily goes to social-emotional support in terms of teachers, our literacy and math support, and our professional learning. We created a platform for curriculum that is unlike anything I've ever seen in any district. And in fact, when we have presented these things locally and nationally, most districts want to adopt it. And so that takes a ton of cost, but it's much cheaper than paying an outside consultant to come in and do the exact same work. And so we pride ourselves on trying to efficient. We returned, I think this year, $4.5 million to the district in costs because we were able to be efficient through scheduling and through training our own to do the work internally and not relying on outside contract or professional services.
So as I wrap the hour, if it does turn out to be maybe 20% more per pupil at East compared to the rest of the district, would you tell the school board and would you tell the mayor and would you tell the superintendent of the Rochester City School District that's worth it?
I would say the 20% increase in school funding, if you compare that to almost a double the graduation rate, which would soon exceed 40%, I think it's well worth it. And I would tell you that the Center for Urban Education Success at U of R is researching these topics and studying these topics to make sure they can be shared locally and nationally. And the university's website for that is urqs.org.
Dr. Sean Nelms, the superintendent of East, as always, nice to see you.
Thank you
very much.
Likewise.
And thanks for telling the story. Lorna Washington, Marlene Blocker, Tanya Wilson, Thaven Asen, Kyle Crandall, all of the room here telling the story of East, and we appreciate all of your time. Thanks, everyone. Thank you very much. Our thanks to Dolores and Gary behind the glass today doing so much work for us. And the best producer in Rochester is also the engineer today. It's Megan Mack. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.